What's really going on in the heads and hearts of the humans around you? I'm Mads Grummet, journalist, entrepreneur and startup investor.
And I'm Sabina Reid, psychologist, speaker and media commentator. And this is Human Cogs, a podcast about the universal experiences that really matter and the candid conversations we need to have to share them.
If you like Human Cogs, we'd love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating.
That way we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all do human well. Being a young person in your 20s is a complicated and challenging time. Whether you're living through this decade of your life now, or perhaps you're a parent to a 20-something, you likely already know that the 20s are the most uncertain decade of life. In this episode, we talk to the always compassionate and wise Dr. Meg Jay. She's a developmental clinical psychologist who is on faculty at the University of Virginia and maintains a private practice in Charlottesville, where she specializes in 20-somethings. Her first book, The Defining Decade, has sold more than 500,000 copies, launched one of the most watched TED Talks to date, and is the topic of 13.7 million views on TikTok. Meg has just released her third book, The 20-Something Treatment, a revolutionary remedy for an uncertain age, in which she upends the pathologizing of young adult life and offers practical skills and hope as she normalizes the hurdles faced by young people to help navigate this important time of life. Meg shares with us why the 20s isn't a developmental downtime to be pushed to the side, but rather a transformative time that paves the way for decades to come. She shares how small tweaks in our 20s can metamorphose our careers, mental health, and relationships for the rest of our life. We also discuss Meg's fascinating second book, Supernormal, The Secret World of the Family Hero, which details stories of people who have faced adversity in the form of death, divorce, mental illness in a family member, abuse, or bullying, and who go on to thrive. We deep dive the impact of keeping family pain in the shadows and the power of sharing secrets to help us grow and develop in healthy ways despite the family dynamics we grew up in or the hardships we endured. Meg's warmth, insights, knowledge, and watertight evidence-based research invite us to rethink our 20s and understand that this decade will not be the best years of our life. In fact, she states if your 20s are the best years of your life, something has gone terribly wrong. This is a not-to-be-missed conversation for any parent and any 20-something. Here's my chat with Dr. Meg Jay. Meg Jay, it's so good to have you here on Human Cogs. And as two psychologists and also two parents, I've got a particular interest in the 20-something decade. I have two daughters. One is 23 and one is 21. So I am in the sweet spot.
I'm glad to be here.
You've got so many gems to share across your three books and TED Talk. But I'd like to start with you as a 20-something. If you and I met in our 20s, who would I meet?
It depends on when in the 20s. When I was 20, I was in college. You would meet a college student. When I was 23, 24, I was an Outward Bound instructor. Do you know what? Probably know what that is in Australia. So that was the first, the middle third of my 20s. And then if you met me at 28, I was in graduate school in Berkeley studying to be a clinical psychologist. So, you know, like many 20-somethings, there were different phases of growth and development. So it depends on when you met me.
But all three of those experiences sound like you had drive, you had focus, you had grit, you were doing undergrad studies, Outward Bound, postgrad studies. That's doesn't sound like a lost somebody or someone.
Well, you would be surprised, actually. I mean, I somehow knew, or I think I definitely was not from a background where I felt like I could sort of wing it, you know, that I definitely needed to come up with something or get something to work. So you know, I got into a good college and felt like I should do that. You know, after school, most people would not have perceived me going to be an Outward Bound instructor as being the most ambitious thing I could have done straight out of a really good university. But, you know, I felt like I had a lot of life to experience, a lot of growing up to do. Of course, being an Outward Bound instructor, you're going to learn a lot about leadership and groups and self-sufficiency and drive and stick-to-itiveness. And so it was great for my development, but I wouldn't say it was the most ambitious thing one could have done out of college. So, but I think I knew enough to know I should do something that other people would lean in and go, that's interesting, tell me more. And that actually did help me when I decided to pivot back to higher ed and apply to go to grad school at Berkeley. People actually, I think, did find me more interesting than your average applicant because I had done something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I knew that I kind of couldn't really afford for my life to go sideways, but I wouldn't say it was the most linear path.
What do you think was the hardest thing for you about your 20s?
The hardest thing for me, definitely, about my 20s, and that's really what I write about in my most recent book, The 20-Something Treatment, is I really struggled emotionally, personally, and, you know, some of it had to do with some not-so-great family stuff, which kind of takes you to my second book, Super Normal, but you know, I think like many 20-somethings, most people don't know this, but our 20s are a mental health low point. I mean, they tend to be the decade when we struggle more with depression or anxiety, substance use, suicidality. I flirted with all of those things like many 20-somethings do. And I think at the time, I didn't realize how common that is, how normal that is. I think I spent more time than I should have thinking that I was broken or different than other people. I mean, I knew I was smart and I could be successful, and that was sort of, you know, easy to do on the outside. But on the inside, I think I thought that I was, you know, more disordered than I actually was. And very fortunately, and I write about this in the 20-something treatment, I encountered some people, you know, some mentors and figures in my life who said, no, you're having a hard time, but there's nothing wrong with you. And that made a big impact on me then. And, you know, you can see that thread in my work now, 25 years later.
So it was off the back of your own experiences that drew you to focusing on this decade?
You know, it actually wasn't. I mean, I think it all kind of comes full circle in a really lovely way. But, you know, I went to grad school at Berkeley. I knew I wanted to do clinical psychology. I thought I would work with kids. I tried to do that and it broke my heart in about 5 minutes and decided I couldn't do that. And, you know, Berkeley's a big college town. So I was working with lots of college students and young adults and just realizing what a sweet spot that was for helping people that, you know, they're out there trying to figure out work and love and identity and life and habits and health. And that if you work with people early on, kind of a small bit of help can go a really long way, as you well know. So mm-hmm. I really learned, and, you know, not just through experience, but through the data, learned about that as a real developmental sweet spot. People really weren't focusing on that area at that time, but that became, you know, my focus. And then now I've done that for 25 years. Mm. So, you know, honestly, my first book, The Defining Decade, was really just out of my work with 20-somethings. And, but you know, now 20-something treatment, writing about mental health, I can see how, oh, yeah, you know, I know something about struggling with mental health in my 20s and, you know, the things that I thought and felt about that and what helped and what didn't help.
Mm. And in your TED Talk, which I think has been seen by, is it more than 10 million people watched your TED Talk?
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. number's probably mm-hmm. gone up. So it's a lot of people that have viewed it and that have an interest in this decade in our lives, over our lifespan. And yet so many people are quick to dismiss this decade. A lot of parents, perhaps teachers, employers, will say, oh, don't worry, you're just in your 20s, it doesn't matter. What do you say to that?
They're not informed that the 20s matter a lot. So, you know, that my first book, The Defining Decade, the subtitle is Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And so it was really about dispelling that myth that I don't know about in Australia, but in the US, there was sort of this saying circulating that, you know, 30 is the new 20, which kind of gives the impression of, well, you know, people start their lives at 30 and what happens in your 20s, it doesn't really matter. Or, you know, stressed out 20-somethings would look to their elders and say, help. And they'd say, oh, you're young. You have all the time in the world to figure it out. And that's actually not helpful to people, just to say, you'll be fine. That they're asking important questions, which is how? How can I help myself be fine? And they want people to sort of dig into that. But there's a lot of unique development going on in our 20s. I'll rattle off some some details. So we know that your learning curve in your 20s in terms of work predicts your earning curve in your 30s and beyond. So you're not going to make your highest salary in your 20s, but in terms of skill development, what you do with that in your 20s really predicts what happens in the next couple of decades beyond. We know personality changes more in your 20s than any other time in adulthood. That's because the brain is changing more in your 20s than any other time in adulthood, right? When life is changing, like work. You know, average age of finding a life partner in the U.S. is about 30. So most people meet those partners choose not to be with other partners somewhere in their 20s. I posted something on Instagram recently, and it was me at 35 graduating from Berkeley, and I was 9 months pregnant with my first baby. And I put it under there's like a data point, you know, 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35. So I was like, here's me squeezing two in just under the wire. But if you trace those backwards, they both started in my 20s. You know, I started grad school in my 20s. I met my partner in my 20s. And, you know, our first baby was born when I was 35. So, you know, adult milestones have moved upwards and they hover more around 30 than they do around 20, at least in the U.S. But we're starting all these projects in our 20s, and it's getting in on those beginnings, I think, is when you can really help people and they don't have to kind of re-engineer their whole lives. You can help them make small course corrections that make a big difference.
And yours is very much a story of hope, isn't it? It's what we can do to equip ourselves. You talk about skills, not pills. And I do want to talk about that. It's particularly prevalent in your latest book, The 20-Something Treatment, that we pathologize and offer pharmacological interventions that really are often not necessary and sometimes very damaging and very harmful. I imagine that there'll be some 20-somethings that could listen to some of what you say and think, help, if this decade is so defining, I've already screwed it up, or I don't know what to do next. They may hear that message, or parents as well, or educators, and understand that message and then feel some sense of paralysis. What now? What do I do now? What are some of your sort of takeout tips there on what can we do tangible today that will help shift the dial and course correct, as you say, as our later decades come to fruition?
Right. Well, I mean, I got a lot of emails during the pandemic, people saying, oh no, the pandemic is, you know, stealing my defining decade. And, you know, life never goes to plan. I mean, I have gotten many emails over the years from people who said, I have to care for an ill parent, or I have cancer, or I lost my job. So, you know, things happen in your 20s so that, you know, no one can perfectly execute all 10 years of their defining decade. And that's not the intention, as much as to say the years matter developmentally. It's a great time to start your life. You don't have to have everything done by 30. And, you know, we all just start with where we are. Some of the people I feel like who have most been able to utilize the defining decade, they pick it up at 28 and go, oh my gosh, I need to do all this right now. And because a lot of it is about small early course corrections, you absolutely can do that at 28 or 31 or 32. There's no cliff that happens at 30. You know, sometimes 20-year-olds pick up the defining decade and you would think, oh, well, they have the whole 10 years to pull it off. But precisely for that reason, they feel like, oh, well, I don't know if I need to do this yet. So I don't think you need all of the 10 years to get the message that, you know, the time is always now, no matter how old you are.
And small changes can create big outcomes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think both books are really very hopeful messages in that the defining decade is about how small changes, you know, it's like in saving for retirement. You start in your 20s and it's going, you know, you don't have to save as much. It's sort of the same principle, but with changes with work and love and personality and habits. The 20-something treatment is really about how, yes, the 20s are difficult, but life gets better as you go, that most 20-somethings, their mental health improves across their 20s as their lives improve across their 20s, and that people tend to feel better across their 20s, 30s, 40s, and that life continues to get better. I think a lot of people hear, on the one hand, we say, oh, the 20s don't matter, no big deal. But then another thing they hear is, these are going to be the best years of your life. And empirically speaking, they're not. They tend to be a challenge, and we can talk about why that is. But I think it's not useful for people to hear these are supposed to be the best years of their lives, because there's a lot of pressure to make that happen, and they're usually quite challenging. And, you know, I tell my clients, if your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something went terribly wrong, that life should get better as you go.
So what do you think are some of the hardest things? And you talk about, even in the tagline of your latest book, The 20-Something Treatment, a revolutionary remedy for an uncertain age. And uncertainty is a key piece to, well, not just the decade of the 20s, but to life forever, always, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes. Uncertainty is the key piece. And that the really tough part about being in your 20s is that tends to be the most uncertain decade of life. It tends to be the only decade of life where you wake up in the morning and you don't know where you're going to live 5 years from now. You don't know where you're going to work. You don't know if you'll be able to pay your bills. You don't know if anyone's going to love you. You don't know who your friends are. Everything is uncertain at once. And that is less likely to be true in your 30s or 40s or 50s. You'll have some things pinned down. And sure, sometimes something goes sideways, or a company where you are working ceases to exist, or a relationship comes to an end, but you have some stakes in the ground. As a 20-something, you often have nothing. So it's overwhelming uncertainty, but it's also your first exposure to uncertainty. So, you know, you go through school and it's very regimented, and there's syllabi and grades and structured, and everything seems, you know, pretty clear. And then you enter into your 20s, and that's the most uncertain life will ever be. And you have the least experience yet with dealing with it. So the brain doesn't like that. The brain perceives uncertainty as danger. And so people tend to feel very anxious and stressed and depressed in their 20s, partly because of that.
So you're talking about anxiety, depression, stress, and then, of course, you and I both know that diagnoses are rife now, ADHD, autism spectrum disorders. What do you think's happening there, that on the one hand, you're describing normal developmental challenges that fit, and yet we've got this high level, and it's the same in Australia, I know it is in the States as well, of pathological diagnoses that are being handed out on a platter to so many young people, which, talk to me about that.
Yeah, I actually just had someone in my office, I'm looking at the clock, 3 hours ago, who was describing, you know, she's early 20s. She said, I really have a problem. I have severe anxiety. And I said, tell me about it. And she said, well, you know, if I meet somebody, I'm not sure if they like me, and I kind of can't stop thinking about it. I wake up in the morning and I feel stressed about all the things that I have to do. There was nothing she described that sounded alarming to me. It sounded very normal, very common. And, you know, we talked some about how her systems of how to get done the things she needs to do maybe could improve. And she was new to a city, so she is meeting new people and she doesn't know if they like her. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and we tend to think people like us less than they do. So we talked about all that. And I said, you know, I'm hearing normal, like exactly what you said, Sabina, I'm hearing normal developmental uncertainty and anxiety. And so I would be cautious about deciding that you have a disorder, you know, deciding that there's something wrong with you. I don't know if that's going to help you build your life here in this new city, feeling like there's something the matter with you. And she said, but my roommate told me that she's on medication and it's like she just experiences a life without anxiety. And I said, well, I don't know what your roommate has. You know, you may not have the same brains. You may not have the same problems. Your brains may not respond to that medication in the same way. But I said, I don't think that you can have that expectation from a medication that you will experience a life with no anxiety. So this is something that I confront daily where people, you know, they see on TikTok that I have like this or that disorder and they imagine that there's since it's in their mind a medical problem, then there must be a medical solution. So I do a lot of psychoeducation around that. And, you know, at the end of the day, of course, it's the client's decision to make what they want to try and do. But that's a conversation I have again and again. Mm.
And you've also raised another point there, Meg, and that's that of comparison with others. In the story you just told, it was her roommate, but it may be someone online or someone you work with or people you went to school with, particularly online, of course, the comparisons are endless. And
right.
Not just in the mental health space, but also in some of the other topics you're talking about that 20-somethings face. Perhaps people have graduated college and they've started to look for first early career jobs. And you'll see some of your friends are out there going gangbusters and you're still spinning in circles. That's a pretty common comparison that I hear people share.
Yes.
Again, also relationships. They've seemed to have settled down. I'm still single or I keep dating people that goes nowhere. What can we do with these high levels of comparison to others, particularly during this decade of our life?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I do a lot of psychoeducation. And really, that's why I started writing books, because, you know, I believe education is an intervention. And many of my clients don't need therapy per se. They need better information than what they're getting, you know, wherever they're looking right now. But I think just helping people understand that, unlike school, where everybody was sort of at the same level at the same time, you know, kind of marching along lockstep, when you go into the adult world, people take wildly different paths at different paces, and you really can't compare two people's lives because they've had different pasts, they have different outsides, they have different insides, they have different everything. And so just to help people realize that it's just not even a useful metric to compare yourself to other people. Of course, the brain's going to do it, which is why I ask people to really pay attention to how they're spending their time, especially on social media, and is it helpful or not helpful for them to be looking at what everyone else is doing instead of getting going on what they want to be doing. So, you know, interestingly, I think there's been a lot of conversation around social media and that 20-somethings are pretty savvy. They know that that's what they're doing, that they go online and they compare, you know, everybody's highlight reels to their real life. And that's kind of not a fair fight. And I think most of them are aware of that, but your brain's still going to do it every time you go on social media and look at what others are up to.
Mm-hmm. But even outside of social media, I think there's a lot of comparison that goes on, particularly in our 20s.
Right. Well, people are trying to, and again, this is they're actually trying to find certainty in the uncertainty. They're like, quantify me, rank me, grade me, give me something. And so I actually think it can be very freeing when you sort of lean into the fact that it can't be quantified. Your life can't be quantified. Mine can't be quantified. They can't be compared. That if you really embrace that, it can be very freeing to realize that actually can't be done. But people are trying to figure out, how do I stack up? So, you know, I ask people to compare themselves to where they were a year ago, or where they are compared to the goals they set for themselves, to really sort of think about those being their metrics rather than what other people are doing.
Yeah, that's very wise advice. Also, in your latest book, The 20-Something Treatment, you talk about 10 key skills that you think are imperative for young people to be focused on. You're talking about how we feel, how we think, how we work, how to be social, how to befriend and connect, how to love, how to have sex, how to cook, how to change, and how to decide. Maybe you could pick three of those which you think are really potent as issues that we can do something about today. As a as a parent, or as someone in their 20s, or as someone who loves someone in their 20s.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'll pick three that I worked with on people today, because that's pretty telling. So one person was in my office, and he's really working on how to think that when the brain is confronted with uncertainty, like I said, it perceives danger. It goes negative. We have sort of better safe than sorry brain. So if we're not sure what people are going to think or do, we think the worst. We go negative. And so usually extremely of what psychologists like you and I, Sabina, call catastrophic thinking. So people think the worst. So this was actually a late 20s male professional also. You know, he's making progress in his profession. He's got a relationship that's sort of beginning to happen, but he really has trouble saying no to people, and that he imagines that if he says no to people, that they will reject him, not want to be with him, not like him anymore, you know, that he takes it all the way to the extreme. And so those are his what ifs. Those are his fears. You know, what if my girlfriend doesn't want to be with me if I tell her I'm not ready to move in? Or what if my job doesn't work out if I tell them I can't work on the weekend? And so that's our emotional, fearful brain reacting to uncertainty. And so, you know, I help clients try to lean into their rational brain and think not just about what if, but about what is. So what do you know? What are the facts in this situation? Have you told your girlfriend no before, and what happened before? Or have you ever not been able to work on the weekend, and has that been okay? Or when's another time that you went to your boss and said, hey, there's something I can't do, can we find a middle ground? And so just to help him be, you know, more factual and less fearful in the moment. Sometimes when you try to do that with 20-somethings, they'll say, well, there aren't any facts because I don't know anything and this is new. So you can say, okay, well, let's lean into being more flexible. That are there other ways that this could go that you're not thinking about? And so we're really just helping people go from that sort of reactive brain to more of a, you know, thoughtful, rational brain, which sounds easy when I describe it. But as we all know, in the moment, when you're confronted with something scary or new or different, as 20-somethings are pretty much all the time, they're just constantly automatically imagining the worst. And so we kind of have to help people make space in their brains for what else might happen in this situation so that they can sort of brave dealing with it. Mm-hmm. So how to think is a big one. How to feel. So if I talk about the young woman I was mentioning a minute ago, that she was feeling anxious about, you know, meeting new people or waking up in the morning and feeling stress. And she wants that to just go away, that's bad. These feelings, I don't enjoy them. They're not fun. I want them to go away. And so, you know, as you know, Sabina, feelings are sources of information. So those feelings are telling me these are areas that she, you know, probably needs to work on. So rather than trying to get rid of feelings, to help people not be afraid of their feelings and try to understand, what are they trying to tell me? What are areas of growth for me? What are things I need to start practicing or changes I need to make, skills I need to build? And I think sometimes when you just recast feelings as not something to be afraid of, but as sources of information, that can be useful. I actually talk about in the 20-something treatment, I took a group of 20-somethings to a Zen monastery in Kyoto. And so they were learning mindfulness meditation, and the Buddhist monk, you know, said, why do you all want to learn to be mindful? And they all said, I want to be happy. I want to be stress-free. I don't want to be anxious anymore. And he was like, well, that's not what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is accepting the feelings that you have and recognizing them and, you know, observing them, learning from them, rather than trying to like push them down or get away from them. And so whether you're talking about mindfulness or not, I think just normalizing that discomfort is a part of life and you can learn from it rather than sort of try to get rid of it and medicate it, whether it's self-medicate it or medicate it through your physician. So thinking and feeling are big, as you know, they go with us everywhere we go. Mm. I think another big one for 20-somethings that I hear the most, which again might sound basic to someone who's not in their 20s at the moment, but is a big one, is how to be social and how to befriend people. And it seems like, well, people must know how to do this by now. They're, you know, 20 or 25. But I often have several clients who are brand new to a city. And, you know, think about the last time you moved to a city and you knew no one and you had to figure out, and you lived alone and you had dinner alone every night and you had to figure out, like, how do I make a friend? That's a challenge when you've grown up, you know, going to school and there's 30 people your age, right, in the same class as you every day. So, you know, a lot around, you know, initiating, you know, how to find friends in your town. You know, I'm thinking of someone right now who just joined a running club or a walking club. And after the walks, they all go to a bar and have a beer after, or joined a pickleball club, or, you know, braving talking to more people at work. But in your 20s, many people are surprised to hear the 20s are actually the loneliest decade of life, that we think of them as being a very social time. But 20-somethings, if you think about it, are solidly between families. So they're really the group most likely to wake up alone in the morning or with roommates that, you know, maybe they're not close with, maybe they're not getting along with, that they have like the least control over who they live with. So it's actually a very lonely time. So helping people make friends during that time is really what, where the support comes from.
Mm, I like what you just said then, that 20-somethings are between families and feeling like they're anchorless in so many ways, that they've gone from one tribe and they're dreaming of another tribe, but they haven't quite found the in-between tribe.
Or even if they do, you know, they'll find friends, but then the friend will move for work, or they'll move for work, or the friend will get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and then they can't hang out anymore. And so I think we imagine that 20-somethings have these like stable friend tribes that support them. And it's actually not often like that, that it's much more, you know, kind of restless than that.
I did only ask for three, but you've also got on your list how to love and how to have sex. And I'd love some of your thoughts on those two.
Yeah, those are big. Those are would be what kind of comes next. One reason I mentioned friendship is having a friend is great training for being a partner. I mean, if you don't know how to be a good friend, you're probably going to struggle in terms of being a good partner. So I often talk to clients about learn how to be a good friend. And then that you know, add intimacy and chemistry and sex to that, you've got a great relationship. But you may be surprised that the How to Love chapter in the book, it talks all about heartbreak, because, you know, how to love for most people is pretty easy. I mean, we're sort of wired to love. The hard part about loving people in your 20s is you're probably going to get your heart broken. And heartbreak or breakups are the leading precursor to, and I'm putting in air quotes here for everyone who can't see me, to depression in your 20s. So young adults are often diagnosed with clinical depression after a breakup, but as you would probably see it too, that's grieving. And grieving is a healthy, natural thing to do after an important loss. And if you don't grieve after an important loss, then I'm thinking maybe there is something wrong with you. But that's actually, you know, I helped clients understand. I actually had someone in my office about this today, that that grieving after a breakup means that you did a lot right. You let yourself love someone, your attachment system's working, and now it's upset that that person is gone, and that's appropriate, and that there's nothing wrong with you that you're going through that, and it will get better. It's going to pass. So actually a lot of the chapter is about not pathologizing the breakup process, because that happens a lot in the 20s. And then the How to Have Sex chapter, of course, I'm not, you know, getting into the nitty gritty on that as much as what I do talk about is, I don't know about in Australia, but in the United States, porn is the leading form of sex education in America. And also in my office today, I had to ask every single new client I have, and I say, you know, we're about to get real familiar, but how much porn are you watching? And sometimes, you know, not surprisingly, more young males will be more likely than young females to say a lot. Some young males will say, you know, I watch some, but I don't think it's a problem, and I believe them. Many will say, I'm watching more than I want to, and I would like to change that, or I don't like how it's making me feel. And so with a lot of young clients, I'm trying to help them brave sort of the in-person intimacy, whether it's someone, usually a young male, who's been watching too much porn, and so that need is being satisfied in that way, and he's having a hard time sort of getting out there and braving relationships, because believe it or not, watching a lot of porn can actually make people feel anxious about sex because they feel like they're not out there doing it. They can't do what they're seeing. It's not really great for transferring into, you know, person-to-person contact. And then there's a lot of young women out there who feel like they're anxious about getting into sexual relationships because they feel like what people are going to want from them is almost porn-like. It's more than they want to commit to in the first date or the first week or the first month. So it's really helping people figure out, how do you brave that and just think about, what if we just start with a kiss? What if we just imagine that and then let things follow from there?
Yeah, these are universal themes, and they're absolutely applicable in Australia in the same way that you're describing in the States. Can I shift gear for a moment? I want to go back to your second book, Supernormal, The Secret World of the Family Hero. You highlight, I think, in this book, the stories of children who have faced adversity growing up, whether that's death or divorce or abuse or addiction or bullying or mental illness in a sibling or in a parent. And these are the children that go on to thrive. And my understanding is, in this family unit, perhaps others are not thriving. So this is the break. Right. This is the breakaway hero, the supernormal hero.
That's right.
This is a fascinating dynamic that I think many people can relate to as a parent or as a sibling and a child themselves, or now adult. Tell me a bit about the book, and also how you're defining resilience in this hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Supernormal is not explicitly or even really implicitly a 20-something book, although I think I wrote it with a lot of 20-somethings in mind, because your 20s are often when you might have grown up with a mentally ill sibling or a parent who is an alcoholic or domestic violence in the home. And you might, and not even just might, but probably would have never said a word about it to anybody until sometime in your 20s, you suddenly, to a therapist or a friend, go, hey, so there was this thing I grew up with. And so oftentimes in early adulthood, people are trying to figure out, what was that? And what do I do now? And is there any hope for me to have a better life than the one I saw growing up? Obviously, if you're growing up with adversity, that work is going to go on often beyond your 20s, so that it's really not targeted as a 20-something book, but I think it's probably useful to a lot of young adults. But I've had many people write to me who were in their 50s or 60s and say, this book just explained my whole life to me. So the family hero, like you said, it's sort of that high achieving, high performing kid who kind of gets out of the situation and then often feels like, you know, they're precociously need to take care of themselves and their families and other people. And they have kind of a heroic existence of where they're, you know, leaping over buildings and dodging bullets and, you know, taking care of others and saving other people and never have a weekend off or, you know, a day on the couch. And actually the book is really, in a way, interrogating the word resilience and kind of saying that we've sort of done a disservice with that word, because people say, oh, you're so resilient, you just bounce right back. And anyone who's, you know, heard that is thinking, you don't know the half of it. There's been no bouncing. This is not how I would describe how I got, you know, from here to there. Mm. So the book is really about sort of the inner world of resilient people. And it's not romanticizing it in any way. It's saying, yes, it's amazing, and it's also an incredible struggle. And that I think we look at, quote, resilient people, and we just imagine that they just bounced right into this, not understanding all that they've been through inside and out to get to where they are. And the book is really about the inner world of those people.
Mm. And I wonder if you also explore that sometimes these heroes have indexed too far the other way in order to perhaps overcompensate for their own experiences or others in the family unit. And at what cost does that come? Because flying in a cape 24/7 is going to come at a cost to all of us.
Absolutely. One of the quotes, one of the best things about the book, it's of the three, all my books are highly researched. I mean, I went to Berkeley, so I, you know, I'm trained in to think from a, you know, if there's not data behind it, I probably shouldn't write books about it, is sort of the way I've been trained. But even though I write about my experiences with clients, I like to find the data to say, you know, it's not just what I'm seeing. It's really, you know, what, like you're saying, your universal themes. But one of the really cool things about Supernormal, it's my most deeply researched book. And I read memoirs, I read superhero, you know, books and comic books and histories of the superhero genre. Of course, I read tons of research, but there's all kinds of cool quotes from amazing memoirs and autobiographies of really, you know, quote, resilient people, you know, what I'm calling super normal. But anyhow, one of them was Alan Moore, who wrote Watchmen, and it's The Art of the Hero, or the, I think it's The Art of the Hero is knowing when you don't need to be the hero anymore. And I think that is something that often, in terms of the development of the family hero, comes a little bit later, maybe often like 30s, 40s. People start to say, I'm exhausted, I'm burned out. Sure, I saved myself and maybe even some other people, but I can't go on like this. I can't sustain this. So that's also very much in the book of when do you get to take the cape off and just be a person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also the cost that secrets bring. And I guess from the stories you've just told then in the flavor of this book, that that superhero may be carrying shame and secrecy of their own, but also on behalf of the tricky people, or the it's not tricky people, it's the unit, it's the family system that they're trying to fly the flag for and keeping secrets for. Do you talk around what cost to keeping secrets for any individual, and what benefits of speaking the truth, which is a fine line to walk when you're telling your truth, which may obviously appear differently to another person in the family unit?
Yeah, I do talk about secrets in Supernormal, and about how, on the one hand, I think when you're, especially when you're younger, I mean, I think there's a lot of cognitive reasons that young kids and teenagers don't talk about problems at home. I think also one reason is that compartmentalizing helps them, you know, have the secret over here, but I can go to school and I can get an A, or I can be on the football team and focus on the game. And so I think it serves a purpose in terms of compartmentalizing when people are younger. But then as you get older, you start to feel like, well, there's something wrong with me if there's something important that I don't feel that I can tell people. And that's true for growing up with adversity. It was true. I had a woman in my office today. I had a very busy day.
Sounds
today,
like Sabina. You had 30 people in your office today.
But I think I had like 9, and you've heard about all of them. So,
for your
listeners in the U.S., it's 8:40 in the evening. So I had a full day of clients, but you know, I had a woman in my office today who was does some self-harming. And she and I are working on that together. And I said, but I really want to get you in a group about this, because she said, I just feel like if people knew that I was doing this, they wouldn't like me, that I would be embarrassed. I would feel so ashamed. And I said, you know, we need to help you find different ways to cope. But also, this, you're not the only person who's leaning on this as a coping technique. And I think it would be really helpful not for you just to talk to me behind closed doors, but to be in a group with other people who are also working on this, because you would probably give them more grace than you're giving yourself about it. So I feel that way about most secrets that people are keeping. I'm actually a huge proponent of group treatment or group support groups for young people for that reason. Is, I mean, I can help people, but therapy can still feel like a secret, and I don't love that. And I think it's better when people can have those conversations, not just one-on-one, but with each other or out in the open.
Mm, I agree with you. And I think this, as you've already explained, is an issue well outside of our 20s. This is relevant to us forever. I think a lot of us still carry some secret, some shame, or feel that we need to dial down a story on behalf of others in our in our family unit, whether that's extended family or not. Okay, so Meg.
Actually, I will quickly, Sabina, I will say one more thing about Supernormal for listeners who are interested. The way I wrote it, the way that I did, is it's the 10 most common childhood adversities, and you named most of them, you know, alcoholism in the family, mental illness in the home, domestic violence, poverty, you know, blah, blah, the 10. And usually books are written for one, you know, just one, like adult children of alcoholics, or, you know, and then that puts people in a minority and they feel like, I'm different, I'm in a minority. But putting them all in this in one book said, you know, 75% of us have grown up with at least one of these. And when you put them all together in this story, this narrative arc that people share across adversities, you realize it's actually not the minority. It's the majority of people who can understand your experience.
And only when you share that do you realize that. And I always say that one of the greatest gifts, I know you'll relate to this, Meg, being a therapist and doing the work that we do in different domains as speakers and in the media and on, you know, bigger platforms where you're not just sitting with one person, is that people often feel they're the only one. And
right.
We have had the privilege to hear so many times, so many stories that repeat the same themes, that we know you, of course, you're not the only one. No one's the only one. And I guess that's one of the messages of all of your books, is this normalizing and this acceptance and knowing that this is part of the normal human, I don't like the word normal, but the typical human experience.
Yeah, right.
And
absolutely.
Pathologize. What can we do? We've touched on it already, but I'm particularly passionate about the over pathologizing that's happening here and medical interventions. You said earlier in this chat, well, it's not up to me. I can educate a client, but if they see their doctor or their physician and they get prescribed meds for anxiety or depression, ADHD, whatever it is, that's their choice. But at a time when they're less informed, how can we bring that message home or reinforce? I'm looking for sort of practical, tangible advice here on helping a young person. And again, this applies across the lifespan too, I think, but particularly helping a young person to say, I'm gonna do the time without the medical intervention here. I'm gonna explore other options with the knowledge that there's hope and that this is probably a response to a you know, experience that I'm having. Normal response to the experience I'm having.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, all my books are really exactly what you said, because I hear so many people say, I'm the only one who blank. And so then when I hear that enough, I'm like, well, that's a chapter. You know, that's clearly something that we need to be talking about more. So it's really helping people realize, oh, so if I go back to the young woman who was earlier today saying I need medication because I'm thinking about whether people like me, hopefully if you read in my book that everybody does this. It's one of the most common, you know, sort. I actually lead with the how to be social chapter. The first sentence is, I'm worried other people don't like me. And then the data that is the number one endorsed item for young people, like on this particular sort of mental health scale, it is the number one concern amongst young people. So I think if people get better information, then they might say, oh, well, wait a minute. So maybe this isn't abnormal. Maybe the solution isn't in a pill bottle. Maybe the solution is in me sort of having some data points of, okay, I have that thought, but then I brave relationships, find out that was not accurate, and, you know, do some of that moving from the catastrophic thinking of people aren't going to like me to realizing usually they do. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is around the normalizing and, you know, suggesting with clients, even the person who is in my office today saying, well, my roommate has medication and she loves it. You know, I have learned that it's probably not wise to dig in my heels and say you can't have it. But I certainly said, well, you know, your brain and her brain are not the same. And I'm not sure if you even have the same thing. And, you know, are there other areas you want to explore? And this, it's almost summertime here. So what's your summer going to be like? And so by the time we were done talking, she said, you know, maybe I'll give it the summer and see if it's different when I'm not in this stressful situation and I'll work on some things. So she kind of loosened up a little bit to understanding that maybe there were some other areas she could try first. I mean, for, you know, kind of normative, mild to moderate anxiety and depression, I mean, frankly, medication should not be the first line treatment. There are some things for which it should, such as bipolar disorder. You pretty much want to get meds on board right away, but that's not what we're talking about here. That meds shouldn't be the first thing. They should really be a bit of the last resort. And so I think just having the courage to say that and normalizing that sometimes putting in the work in other areas first, you will get better results, because medication wasn't going to fix any of the things she was talking about. It just might make her feel a little bit less anxious along the way. Mm. So you'll get better results if you develop the skills, and skills don't have side effects, and mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. prescription never runs out. So, you know, we all benefit.
Yeah, I think we're singing from the same hymn sheet here. Meg, do you think there's another TED Talk in your back pocket? Because you've got so much wonderful content. It's, as you say, it's all evidence-based through the training of Berkeley, and I can just tell the way that you approach, the way you think, what's important to you. Are we going to hear another TED Talk?
That is a good question. Maybe. I've actually, you might hear another TED Talk. You might hear, I'm on social media more than I used to be, kind of realizing that's where my people are. So that's where they're getting a lot of their bad information. So I guess I better get on there and contribute some good information. Mm-hmm. So I'm mm-hmm. actually doing more in that space these days, but you never know where I'll pop up next.
So if people are wanting to follow you, where can they learn more? There's three books, The Defining Decade, your latest one's The 20-Something Treatment, and your second book, Supernormal, The Secret World of the Family Hero. Where else mm-hmm. can people follow you and find out more?
Yeah, I'm at Dr. Meg J on Instagram, Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. You found me as just Dr. Meg J. There's a little bit on TikTok. Could have ultimately be more out there. But so most places I'm Dr. Meg J. Yeah. Our website is also Dr. Meg J.
Okay. All right. And two more questions before we wrap up, Meg.
Okay.
What would you tell your, you know, we started by meeting you in your 20s. You were outward bounding. You were undergrad, you know, student. You were postgrad student. What would you tell your 20-something self today, with all the knowledge that you've amassed over the last 25 years?
What? That's easy, because people ask me this a lot. So I'm ready for this one, Sabina. But what I would tell my 20-something self, certainly based on my most recent book, is that I'm more okay than I think I am. You know, that maybe you struggle a lot in your 20s, but, you know, there wasn't anything wrong with me. It was just a really hard time. And that life gets better. I think it's very hard for a young adult brain to think ahead in 5 or 10 or 15 year chunks, or to imagine, they can't quite imagine, you know, what could be so great about being in your 30s or 40s or 50s. But very few people say that their 20s were their favorite or best decade. And I actually think for most 20-somethings, the best is to come.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the final question that we always ask on this podcast on Human Cogs is, who do you think is doing human well?
Oh my goodness. People always stump me on these last questions. I mean, of course, Adam Grant came to mind because that's how I
we
connected. So he came to mind. So I, you know, I should go with my gut there. I think he is a really not just a fantastic public intellectual, but he is a just a truly great, supportive, generous, good guy who's very generously supportive of other people's work. And you actually don't often or always see that in, you know, sort of very sought after public figures.
Well, he speaks in glowing terms about you. In fact, about your recent book, The 20-Something Treatment, he says, young adults are struggling with mental health and clinical psychologist Meg Jay is here to help. With clarity and compassion, she explores what causes and cures quarter-life crises. It's a powerful read on improving well-being. So he is doing human well, but so are you, Meg. And thank you so much for joining me today. I think there's so many takeaways here for our young people, which means there is also for us as parents and perhaps for all of us across the lifespan, not just in our 20s. Thank you for your beautiful and brilliant work.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Human Cogs. We hope that this conversation has led you to think a little bit differently about yourself and those around you.
And thank you for all the amazing feedback that we get about these conversations. If you do like Human Cogs and what we're doing, we would love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating. What that means is we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all
do human well.